Blog Talk Radio.
Gonna tell you a little bedtime tale, legend it will become. Burgers flying out the door, sail on. 2-for-1, no concern for the future, living for today. Fast food bite on your way, lay it all to waste. The masses are afflicted now. Moo, mad cow, mad cow. Mad cow, line dance song.
Hello, all you Turnbuckle fans. This is QT Vokes with you on another Friday of the Turnbuckle Turmoil Show. Sign Guy could not be with us today because, as we speak, he is making his way to the WCWO Outlaw Arena at 1122. Well, I think that's the address. 1876, I'll settle for that, Kentucky Avenue in Indiana. Yes, he left SeaTac on Thursday to fly Indiana, and boy, are his arms tired. Today, we have on wrestling manager Count Grog, or we're supposed to. He hasn't quite showed up yet. He's been in the business a long time and is a proud member of Gouge Wrestling. And until he comes on, well, I would like to read to you a book that Sign Guy gave me before he left. It's called The Big Bam, and it's about the life and times of Babe Ruth. Now, I'm going to open up to a random page since Count Grog hasn't quite showed up. And let me see. What page is it? Okay, 116. And I'll read a couple sentences. Hopefully, Count Grog will be with us shortly. Okay, here we go. On August 16th, the Yankees played host to the Cleveland Indians at the Polo Grounds on a sticky, muggy day. It was an important series, the home team a half game behind the visitors in the standings, both teams battling with the White Sox for the American League lead. American League lead, yes. Let me see. I think this thing. Okay. Carl Mays was on the mound. Mays, the subject of so much consternation a year earlier when he went from Boston to New York, was having another good season. He was 29 years old now and still seemed as a dark and odd character. The son of a Methodist minister in Kingfisher, Oklahoma, he didn't smoke, drink, or chase women into the night. And when he chased women, I wonder what his 40-meter time it was. Like 4.9, 4.8? Just kidding. Okay, which made him something of an outsider in baseball culture. He was distant to most of his teammates, disdainful of baseball players as a rule. He was known as a hard case once he crossed onto the field, a no-nonsense competitor, a hard thrower who demanded that hitters stay back from the plate. As a boy, his arm was so strong and accurate that he hunted rabbits with rocks, although he admitted he once made a mistake and hit a calf in the forehead with one of his throws, killing the calf. A sore arm while pitching in the minor leagues in Portland, Oregon, had sent him to old-time legend Iron Joe McGinty, who convinced him to throw with an underhanded submarine motion. The switch was a success and had brought him to the big leagues. Matched against Indians ace Stanley Kovalevsky on this day, Mays and Ruth and the Yanks had fallen behind 3-0 after 4 innings. The first Indians batter in the fifth was 29-year-old Ray Chapman, a nimble shortstop who was the opposite of Mays in personality. A well-liked, gregarious character whose tenor voice could sing the songs of Irishman Jack McCormick to perfection. Chapman, off a Kentucky farm, had married well. His wife, Katie, the daughter of millionaire Cleveland businessman Martin Daly, one of the founders of Standard Oil. Boy, that's a lot of money there, Standard Oil. Back in the teens. Yes, an office already had been established for the shortstop and Daly's company his future assured. In two previous appearances at the plate against Mays this day, Chapman had bunted twice, one for a sacrifice, one for an out. He was an aggravating hitter with a stance that made him sort of hang over the plate, a challenge. Mays threw him a ball, then a strike. On the third pitch, coming from that submarine delivery, the only underhanded delivery in the league, Mays hit Ray Chapman square in the forehead. Okay. The sound crack was as loud as if the bat had hit the ball. The ball rolled toward third base, and Mays, in fact, thought it was another bunt. He fielded the ball and threw it to first. When he turned around, he saw Chapman trying unsuccessfully to climb off the dirt. Some blood was coming from Chapman's ear. After almost 7 minutes, the Indians' trainer and his teammates tried to walk Chapman to the clubhouse in center field, but he collapsed again on the way. His skull had been crushed. He was taken to nearby St. Lawrence Hospital in the Bronx, where doctors operated that night to take the pressure off his brain. But he died at 4:40 in the next morning. He was the first and only major league player to die from being hit by a thrown baseball. Sorry about that. I haven't had my coffee. Okay. Mays, the loner, was now more alone than ever. The players on both the Red Sox and Tiger teams announced that they wouldn't play against him and wanted him banned for life. He protested that the pitch wasn't even a fastball, that it was a curve, that the ball was scuffed and took off. He also noted that Joe Bush of the Red Sox and Howard Emke of the Tigers, 9, had hit more batters than he, 6. Okay, let me see now. That was Joe Bush hit 10 batters, and Red Sox Howard Finke had hit 9, and he had hit 6. Okay, the league office quickly exonerated him, calling the death an accident. Chapman, it was thought, had lost sight of the ball because he never moved, but the controversy remained. When Mays made his first start, a 10-0 shutout of the Tigers a week later, time he released a curveball that didn't seem as if it were going to break, he shouted, "Watch out!" from the mound. Boy, that was it really got into his head. Okay. The game back at the Polo Grounds had continued after Chapman left. The Babe was the first man up in the ninth, the Indians ahead 4-0, and he was 0-3 on the day against Kovleski, but singled sharply. The Yankees scored 3 times in the inning, but still lost 4-3. The game the next day was postponed. Wow. Okay. So they went on playing, and then they decided not to play following day. Okay. The Babe became a movie star in the following weeks, or at least he made a movie. He had signed in July to appear in Head and Home, the story of a village simpleton's rise to baseball glory and the capture of the hand of a local fair maiden. No typecasting here. The deal was not unusual. Sports stars were increasingly being brought into the growing movie business. Timing was peculiar. The Babe made the movie almost immediately in the middle of the season. The studio was in Haverstraw, New York, 30 miles outside the city and on the other side of the Hudson River. For a succession of August days, often nights, Ruth took the ferry to New Jersey, drove to Haverstraw, played his role, and returned back on the ferry to the pennant race. He was supposed to receive $50,000 for his efforts. The producers, Kessel and Bauman, paid him $15,000 up front and gave him a second check for $35,000 to hold for a few weeks until they could put enough money in the bank. He folded the check and put it in his wallet and carried it everywhere. He was not averse to showing it in the locker room. Remember, people, $35,000, and I think that was in 1920. Boy, that's 1921. Yes, it's a lot of money. Even today, I could buy like a compact car. Yes. Okay, $35,000. Okay. Hey, I need some money, he would say. Big joke. Pull out the check, which soon became worn-looking. Could you cash this for me? During the production, there were days when he arrived at the ballpark and didn't even have time to wash off the makeup. He would make monster faces in the clubhouse, then go out to be the first man in baseball history to play right field with eyeliner and mascara. On the morning of August 22nd, he filmed all the live baseball scenes before a crowd of 2,000 at a local field in Haverstraw, also known as the Polo Grounds. With a bat he supposedly had whittled from a tree trunk, he sent shots over the fence off Constable Peter Riley's house and into Frank Smith's front yard and onto a shed and into someone's kitchen. He then left the filming and played against the Detroit Tigers in the afternoon in the real Polo Grounds. Holy smokes. Okay. If he had any reservations, any worries that this movie making might hurt his home run making, he certainly didn't show them. He had developed an attitude to match his celebrity. His uninhibited behavior from Boston now wrapped in a true sense of privilege. The rules for everyone else didn't matter. He paid attention to signs given on the baseball diamond. He paid no attention to signs given on the baseball diamond, did whatever he wanted on each at bat, and very soon no signs were given. He paid no attention to signs anywhere, probably even stop signs. On the road, he no longer had a roommate. He often didn't even stay in the same hotel with the rest of the team, choosing to rent his own suite somewhere else for $100 per day. On short travel with the team, riding in his own car with his own choice of company, Helen could come, friends could come, he could pick out coaches or players to take on the ride. On longer trips, he had his own compartment on the train, freed from the upper lower snores and grunts in the rest of the car, but most importantly, from curious fans. He was living the same life as his teammates, but on an entirely different plane. If there was any resentment about any of this, he never heard it. He continued to hold Miller Huggins, whom he routinely called Little Boy or the Flea, in obvious disdain. He liked his teammates well enough, but except for a few regulars, remembered none of their names. He used his universal, "Hey, kid," with almost everyone. Payphone that he never answered had been installed next to his locker, a payphone. Now, I bet you that was a first in the major leagues, next to his locker. I didn't think they had payphones way back in 1920. Oh, well, I digress. Let me see. For his personal calls, teammates answered, told female callers that they were the babe, and made dates for meetings at Hotel Astor that were never kept. The mail also never was answered. He had teammates and trainer Doc Moore sort through it for letters from women and checks. Doc Moore once totaled up 6,000 in checks from envelopes that simply had been discarded. $6,000. Okay. The life he chose to live seemed to be the life of Henry the VIII or Louis the XIV. He could be crude or rude or quite kind. His disposition at the moment told him what to do. There were no other constraints on a king. When we get to Cooper Carlton, there will be a stack of mail for me as big as my... He boasted one day to sports writer Fred Lieb of the New York Telegram as they shared a cab to the hotel from the Chicago train station. And I can't really read the following thing. Okay. A believer in reincarnation, I always felt that Ruth was a reincarnated African king or Arabic emir with a stable of wife and concubines. Well, now, who said that? I couldn't read the following paragraph. Cooper Carlton. Okay. Let me see now, Cooper Carlton. Lieb wrote years later in a book called Baseball as I Have Known It, or perhaps in an earlier life, he lived in ancient Babylon, where they worshipped phalluses. Babe also inherently a phallic worshiper. It cropped up regularly in his conversations. His phallus and home run bat were his most prized possessions in that order. Oh boy, that's something. The phrase that always had been used to describe him, he's like a big kid, had been altered. He was now pretty much a big spoiled kid or a kid who was out of control. All right, Count Grog is still not here. I will read one last paragraph, and then I'm afraid I'll have to go. Yes. Okay, because I also have to go to work. Yes, okay, here we go. In the last few days of making the movie, he was stung on the wrist by a wasp, or maybe it was bitten by a tick. After the spot became infected, it was lanced, and then stitched. He missed 6 games in the middle of the pennant race. The other players grumbled. But then he came back on Labor Day weekend at Fenway Park in Boston. This was the Yankees' last visit during the season. To honor the exploits of their transplanted star, the local Knights of Columbus presented him with a set of cufflinks at the September 4th doubleheader, which was dubbed the Babe Returned the Honor by belting home run number 45 into the right field bleachers in the first game, then repeating with home run number 46 to the same spot in the second. Another record had been dredged up. Pete Warden of Minneapolis in the Western League had hit 44 home runs in another bandbox park in 1894 for the minor league record. So now Ruth had the record for all of organized baseball. The New York Times referred to him after this exhibition as the behemoth of a bangs. I wonder if they called Count Grog that, the behemoth of bangs. Where would it all end? Well, okay, folks. Well, let me see now. What time is it? 3:17, 17 minutes. I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut this short. It looks like Count Grog, manager at Gouge Wrestling, and a famous Halloween bash of September. I think it was September 29th or 30th, with Sign Guy as referee 2 years ago. That was a good match. He was in the ring. I guess he hasn't shown up. So I will now hit the exit music. Yes, sadly. Hopefully, Count Grog, we can have you sometime else, because I wrote a lot of questions. Actually, I can't really do a question. Okay. Because that would spoil. Okay. I'll just hit the music. Okay. And Sign Guy, good luck tonight at Kentucky Outlaw Arena. Kentucky Avenue, the Outlaw Arena, where I once couldn't find because I showed up at a football stadium. Okay. Here we go. Oh, that's our entrance music. Okay. Just a second. Ow. Okay. So that's not. What's this one? Oh, okay. That's not really okay. Oh, that's Debbie Downer. Okay.
Through the annals of history.
Oh, okay. There's Darth Vader's music.
Beep, 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 beep.
What's this one? Oh, okay. I've heard that one before. Okay, bye, people. I'm sorry about this, but we'll be back Sunday. I'll have to check who we have. Okay, bye. Good luck, Sun Guy. Yes.